From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Mormons aren't the only ones that have a tough time talking about sex. Like all conservative faiths, Latter-day Saints have the usual taboos and prescriptions against promiscuity. Lots of talk about virtue and modesty and restraint. But Mormonism is different from some of these other faiths in that the body is good. Sexuality is good. That sex is not just for having children, it's a method of progress. And pleasure is good. But our guests today say, in practice, these two values, passion and chastity, often clash, which leaves Latter-day Saints with some mixed messages and some unhealthy ideas, not to mention some very creative, if not strange, practices. Today in the program, Mormons and sex, after the news.
Support for Radio West comes from thousands of sustainers, listeners just like you who give ongoing monthly donations to help pay for the public radio shows they rely on. Show your love for Radio West by becoming a sustainer, starting at just $5 a month at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Latter-day Saints and their ideas about sex. And why are we doing a show about this? Well, for a number of reasons. It's interesting, first of all. Mormonism has some unique features among conservative Christian religions and its beliefs about sexuality. But there also seems to be a disconnect between a theology that says sex within the proper boundaries of marriage is a good thing and the shame and guilt and taboo that often comes with the rules about sex. Some Latter-day Saints have been left with mixed messages and unhealthy and unrealistic ideas about sex. And here's another reason to talk about this. These ideas can be more far-reaching in Utah than just within the bounds of Mormonism itself, in that public policy related to sex education and abortion and teenage pregnancy is debated by lawmakers, let's be honest, most of whom are Mormon. Now, this may be obvious, but today's conversation is about sex. It may get candid. I hope, actually, it does get candid. So this is not a show for everyone, including your kids, if they're nearby. Here are some questions to consider in the meantime. What was your sex education as a Latter-day Saint? How did that affect your life? If you're married, was that a difficult transition in your sexual life? How are you planning to talk about sex with your partner, with your kids? And do you think things might be changing in Mormonism related to sex? Joining us is Kristen Hodson, a certified sex therapist and a founder and director of the Healing Group in Salt Lake City. It's a mental health clinic. She's also co-author of the book Real Intimacy, which is written for an LDS audience, published by the LDS Press Cedar Fort. She herself is Mormon, and she's joining us in the studio. And welcome. Thanks for being with us. Jennifer Finlayson Fife is also joining us, also a Latter-day Saint, a licensed sex and relationship therapist based outside of Chicago. She also offers online courses for LDS couples and is joining us from Chicago Public Radio. Jennifer Finlayson Fife, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And Chris Deuce is with us. He's a comedian, and we need some comedy maybe a little bit here, a little comic relief. He's a comedian, but also a podcaster based in Los Angeles and host of Celestial Sex. It's a podcast about sex for people raised Latter-day Saint. He's a former Mormon, graduated from BYU. He's joining us from the studios of NPR West in Culver City. Chris Deuce, welcome to you.
Hi, Doug. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so I want to hear you all on this subject, and I want to begin. I hope this doesn't seem like a diversion or something tawdry or something kind of silly, but I want to ask about some sexual practices that I've heard of by young Latter-day Saints. Now, these may be urban myths. I'm not entirely sure, but if they're true, they may say something interesting about what young people understand about sex and how they create these kind of creative workarounds. Kristen, I'll put this question to you first. What is floating?
Floating could also be known as docking, soaking. And what it is you basically insert the penis into the vagina and you don't move. So it's not counted as intercourse or real sex.
Or at least they think it's not.
Right. Yeah. These are the creative workarounds where, nope, we just docked, we just soaked, we didn't have sex.
And it happens.
So I keep a pulse on what happens out of BYU. There's really creative workarounds. And I have had people in my office that have reported these very things. And so I find them to not be urban legends, but workarounds to stay within the lines of chastity.
Yeah. Chris, have you heard of this stuff?
Definitely. We've got, you know, people that come on our show that have experimented with all kinds of ways to, you know, they're having sex without having sex,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. I've heard of gazing.
Yeah, gazing. My roommate at BYU, I remember we had a quiet moment together where he confessed to me that he was gazing and you know, had this very wonderful look in his eye. It was
wait. What is gazing, though? What is gazing? I know it's a thing.
Yeah, so gazing is when you and your partner will undress each other or undress yourselves, and then lay down, you know, light a candle or put a desk lamp on and look at each other's naked bodies and, you know, get pleasure out of that.
Kristen, Jennifer, you want to say anything about this? Are you hearing these same things, these same kinds of stories?
I'm familiar with some of them, although maybe a little bit less, because I tend to work more with LDS couples who are now married and are working on issues that are happening in
after the real sex. But, yeah. But we can't move along before, Kristen, you say something about armpit sex.
This seems to be the 2017 trend, where a girl, I imagine it can be any gender, but would hold their arm to the side and create kind of an orifice that could be penetrated, which really is only pleasure for one, but it's still another workaround.
Okay, now that is weird, right? And it's interesting, but I think that reveals something. Kristen, let's start with you. What do you think this reveals, that you've got these young people doing these workarounds? Either they are kind of naive about sex or kind of smart and creative about finding these ways around the rules.
Absolutely, because there's not an encouragement or development around the sexual self, self-integrity, or if we use Mormon doctrine or language, agency around where their values are. And there's a hard line of not having sex. Well, ask anyone what's their definition of sex, and you are going to get a million definitions, and you're going to have it's penis to vagina intercourse. And so that means everything else is fair game. You have moral, sex, all of these different things. So I think it really speaks to the lack of personal authority over their own sexuality and allowing someone to dictate what the rules are and how close can I get to that rule without breaking it.
Chris, what do you think it reveals?
I think it is we're horny, right? Can I say that word, by the way?
I didn't get a list
of what I can and can't say.
Yeah.
We want to be human. We want to have these close, intimate moments. But, you know, we're also, as LDS people, petrified that by partaking in the sins of the flesh that we're going to, like, we're not going to be able to get into the celestial kingdom after we die, right? Or that we'll face the shame and fear of having to later on confess these things to our bishops. And I remember when I was at BYU and I, you know, had a partner, I totally had a line in my mind of, like, I can go up until this point before I have to confess. And as long as I toe that line, I can, you know, look my bishop in the eyes and tell him that not only am I a full tithe payer, but I, you know, can pass the sacrament on Sunday.
So, Kristen, they're negotiating their boundaries, basically. Is it because they don't understand the boundaries that the rules aren't entirely clear?
I think the rules are, well, that's a good question, clear, unclear, because you will have like the For Strength of Youth that is informing adolescents.
Say what that is.
It's the guidebook and the standards for youth within the church. So ages 12 to 17, 18. And so it does have guidelines around sexuality. And that's changing regularly, especially in the digital age. As I track it, they've taken masturbation out of the law of chastity, the For Strength of Youth, but they haven't publicly said, hey, we're taking this word out. It just quietly happens. So there can be confusion there. So I think you also have interpretation, subjective interpretation. You have bishops that are interpreting what it's a lot of information that can be interpreted.
I want to ask about Mormon theology related to sex. Jennifer, let me hear you on this. You say Mormon theology embraces the idea of the body. So sexual pleasure, I suppose, sexuality, that's an important part of, I guess, the way Mormons think about eternal progression?
Yes. I mean, I think Mormons have a fairly unique, as far as Christian faiths go, a fairly unique understanding of the body. Most Christian ideologies see the body as a threat to spirituality, that sexuality is a necessary evil, essentially. But Mormon theology is very explicit in the idea that we believe in embodied parents in heaven. We believe the body's necessary for spiritual progression. And implicit in that, at least, is our sexual nature. And so, you know, I'm often speaking to members of the church about another way, I think, a more healthy and more valuable way of thinking about our theology, that sexuality is, in fact, inherent to being divine beings. It's inherent to our progression. It's inherent to joy in life. Doing it with integrity, meaning having a relationship of integrity to your sexuality and to others with your sexuality, is critical to that development, but that it doesn't interfere. And there are many ways to interfere with spirituality that can be about being either indulgent sexually or being too repressed sexually. I think they both have negative impacts on the psyche and spiritual and relational capacity of people.
Is it significant that Mormons believe there's a God, but God has a partner, has a wife, who procreates, basically procreated humankind? Mm-hmm. I'm getting that right, yes?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's certainly been different iterations and different interpretations of the nature of a father and mother in heaven and of their sexual nature. The earlier interpretations, I think, were consistent with our notions of men's and women's roles and that women were essentially procreative, and so that Mother in Heaven was, in fact, that was her primary sexual nature. That is an interpretation. Certainly, it's not my favorite interpretation. I think it's a very limited one. Rather, I talk more about the divinity of sex, or to say its spiritual capacity lies within the our ability to forge deep intimacy, the ability to belong deeply to ourselves, to our sexual nature, and to share ourselves deeply with another person. That's the most transcendent and potentially spiritual experience that human beings report. There's a kind of expanding beyond the limitations of the body through the ability to push the limits of the body through sexuality, and to share that with another person is probably one of the best experiences we as human beings get to have.
What do you think about that?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think that procreative limitation, though, it's kind of that idea of women are to be desired,
the vessels,
to not have their own desire and to claim it, yeah, and the pleasure. And one of the interesting things in our book, in chapter 2, we talked about God, God the Father, God the Mother, as sexual beings and the capacity even for orgasm. And that was cut and controversial.
The whole chapter was
instantly
taken out, right?
No, that
just that section,
because that was a very human animalistic trait, and that divinity or God is better than the human experience of sexuality. And what we're experiencing is much more low-level or terrestrial or celestial sexuality, which to me, the capacity, as Jennifer's saying, to have pleasure beyond measure that we can't even comprehend what that can be, is a really exciting prospect.
But how do... Okay, so all of these ideas that you have that are ideal related to the theology, that people should be making these connections. I guess the question is, and I'll put this question to you first, Chris, Are these high-minded ideas about Mormon theology and sexuality filtering down to mainstream believers?
Well, I mean, number one, like the idea that there is a heavenly mother is something that's whispered at church, but is still very like controversial. And, you know, we have a lot of feminist writers right now who are exploring that idea. Rachel Hunt Steinblick, she's someone who's writing a lot about Heavenly Mother. But the amount of information that we have about her is so limited that even like attempting to explore the idea that maybe Heavenly Mother has an orgasm is it's downright bizarre. And I don't think that, you know, people in Elders Quorum or Relief Society are ever even talking about that, right? But I think overall, at least the sense that I got, it was accepted that God is probably having an orgasm and that God is using the same means that we do to procreate. And that up in heaven there are, you know, God's sperm that are fertilizing eggs. But, you know, this concept of pleasure, I just don't think that it's filtering down at all. And the effect that that's had on the women in the church and in the conversations about how partners should be pleasuring each other, it's distorted it to the point that as a young man, I was never, ever taught about pleasuring a woman or that was even a priority that, you know, but it was implied that my own pleasure would be taken care of because of how easy it is for me to have an orgasm.
What Chris is speaking to, I have written about and talked about a lot, which is so I agree that many of these ideas have not filtered down to the mainstream at all because there's been many more prevailing, dominant, more destructive ideas and a very gendered relationship to sexuality. So I wrote my dissertation on Mormon women and sexual agency and looking at the impact of a male biased ideology or a male-led institution and its impact on our notions of women, women's nature, and women's sexual nature. And this idea of women's pleasure, not just in LDS culture, but in the larger culture, is really secondary to men's pleasure. And our notions of God, our notions of maleness, our notions of femaleness, not only have been sort of limited in thinking about pleasure as a potential virtue or as an inherent part of being human, but also prioritizing male pleasure over female pleasure. So women, many of the women that I work with, you know, really dislike sex, never want to have sex, and who could blame them because they have never seen it as something for them or for their pleasure. They have seen it as a way to service a husband, as a way to prove their goodness through putting out for eternity, but not about really embracing their sexual nature and creating a relationship that is responsive to both people in the partnership. And so those are ideas that I talk a lot about. How I think of it is to challenge the sort of false traditions that are alive and well in the larger culture of the church.
What do you mean by false traditions? I think I know what you mean.
False traditions is a phrase in the Book of Mormon in talking about how we can inherit false ideas from the generations ahead of us that limit our spiritual or relational development. And the idea of staying open to what is true and what is good, that's an inherent a part of development as a human being. And so I often use that language in thinking about there's many ideas that have been given gospel status that are borrows from the larger culture, fear-based attempts to basically keep our kids chaste, for example. And so we borrow these ideas that are very destructive, that are often very sexist, and in my view, they don't speak to the core of our theology. They aren't an expression of it, although many people would say that they felt that they were, that those ideas were.
I can't tell if this is some of these ideas that come from the Mormon pulpit or have are really outdated and were just expressions from men of a certain generation, or if they're still believed by people. And let me explain what I mean. And I think there are a lot of examples of this. There was a Mormon leader named Marion G. Romney. He was in the governing first presidency of Mormonism. This was in the 70s, where he gave a talk. This was a talk that he gave to the youth of the church, and he said that a person would be better dead clean than alive unclean. And he told the story of being with his parents at this railroad station. He was preparing to go off on his mission. And his father told him this. Let me quote this. He said, "When you are released and return, we shall be glad to greet you and welcome you back into the family circle. But remember this, my son. We would rather come to this station and take your body off the train in a casket than to have you come home unclean, having lost your virtue." I have a number of these kinds of similar kinds of quotes by church presidents and church apostles. Kristen, let me ask you, and I want to hear all of you on this. Is that a thing from the past, or are people still thinking this way?
I think that's a wrestle. I think you have people that want to push the conversation and push it in a different direction. And then you have these old ideas that continue to get passed on. It's not uncommon for a young girl. I've had a client, or where this has shown up, where she was told by her leader it would be better to die than to be raped. Well, that rape isn't her choice. That's not a choice. And the internalization of that, or the sexual abuse around that, that can happen unknowingly. And so these messages get passed on. And I think there's a wrestle, and we're not intentionally. You have the Unitarian Church that has the OWL program on sex ed. They're intentionally and actively doing sex education. They're intentionally steering those messages. We're still not steering these messages in a proactive, healthy way, starting young. So you still have a lot of interpretation. It just was a year ago, or maybe this year, where Boyd K. Packer's The Little Factories booklet was taken out of print in 2017.
You're saying something that some people may have no idea what you're talking about. Boyd K. Packer was a Mormon leader, died not so long ago.
Yes.
He gave a speech
for young men
about
only.
About their little factories.
The little factories, yeah. And how masturbation and these things are bad. So this stuff continues to be in print, and it's not getting rescinded. So the messages are still out there. I get questions repeatedly from people, can we do this? Can we do that? And so while I wish I could say, oh, these are old messages, they're still alive and well because we're not actively countering them. We're not actively dismantling them and saying, yes, that's old. That's a part of our history. That's part of our narrative.
Chris,
Little Factories was rescinded?
It's out of print, not rescinded, out of print.
Yeah, it looks like I'm in luck.
Yeah, out of print. So get your copies.
Why? You're going to sell them on eBay? Do you have some or something?
I got a whole stockpile of them in my garage.
So wait, what are you hearing about these ideas on your pod? What are you hearing when you talk to people?
So what I'm hearing, my mind immediately goes to the gay and lesbian transgender communities where, you know, people are killing themselves. That's true. Our young people are killing themselves so as to not be left with the choice to sin or be miserable for the rest of their lives, right? We had a guy on Celestial Sex who had to disguise his identity because he's still a BYU student, but he is gay. He's out to the people that he's closest to, but for, you know, most of his life, he was so strict when it came to following, the church rules or whatever, because he thought that it would make him straight. If he was following the gospel and the commandments to, you know, the nth degree, then his sexual orientation would change. That's what he thought, right? It's not true. It made him sad. And now that he's out to the people that he's closest to, he's a lot happier, and I'm sure once he's done at BYU and he can start dating without fearing that his entire education and possible, like, his career may be at risk, right? He'll do that. But that is the message that young people get. And I think that has a lot to do with what we're talking about. There are certain types of sex that seem to be in bounds and lots of types of sex that seem to be out of bounds. And as time presses on, those boundaries are definitely shifting, right? As we've talked about with masturbation being taken out of For Strength of Youth pamphlet. But in the past, it was appropriate to have sex with, you know, all of your wives, right? Polygamy wasn't that long ago that it was a sex law, and they'd figured out a way to have sex with more than one person. I get that that's also up for debate, but that's how I see it. So yes, I see those boundaries shifting.
Jennifer, do you see the boundaries shifting at all?
Yeah, I do see them shifting, and I agree with Chris and Kristen on the struggle between, you know, old ideas and newer, more evolved ideas, and, you know, low accountability on the leadership side in terms of articulating a clear position, and also the ambivalence on the side of the saints to discredit something that an apostle or prophet said, even if it was 50 years ago. Yeah. Meaning it gets hard to know, like, what does it mean to live in accordance to God's will around sexuality? So I do talk a lot to people about the idea of their own agency, their own moral agency, and their own ability to discern what is actually in line with their own sense of right and wrong, and to trust themselves more in making decisions, given the contradictory positions sometimes around sexuality.
I should take a break. I'm so late on this break. But I want to take a call first, though, from Steve, who's joining us in Provo. Steve, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. So I'm a former BYU bishop and a father of three returned missionary boys. And one of the great challenges is regarding this masturbation issue. And, you know, I know there's sometimes when there's the bishops that will say, hey, you can't go on a mission until you're 1 year masturbation free. Or other bishops will be like, hey, this is normative behavior. As long as it's not a severe addiction and it's once every 2 or 3 weeks, you know, let's get you out there. I wonder if your guests could comment on this. And as a bishop, I used to have a lot of struggle, even with my own kids and also the young people in my ward, the profound impact of the shaming and really not claiming their sexuality. And mm-hmm. if I could just mention just quickly, this idea of abstinence is great, but there's just no dialogue around how do we do this in a healthy way? How do we claim our sexuality and do it with integrity? And I wonder if they'd comment on that.
Let me ask you this first, Steve, before you go. If a young person, boy or girl, admitted to masturbating, what did you do?
You know, that's a really great question. And my view of it is that it was more normative behavior, as long as it wasn't really, you know, just like the frequency was paralyzing their life. And this is difficult because I felt like I was in a different place than the church as a bishop. And so,
wait, but what's the rule? What is the rule?
It's very unclear. There's really no training or guidance, and it has to do with what the view of the stake president might be. And, wow. You know, I think generally much now, at least I believe at BYU, there's much, much more enlightened view on this. But the reason why I wanted to call is I see these young people just shaming and demoralizing themselves, feeling like addicts, feeling like they're just condemning themselves and literally paralyzed, and that this sexual urge isn't taken from them. And I just want to say, this is a beautiful, wonderful thing. Take this, but let's talk about how do we do it in a wonderful way.
We're going to get to the conversation about how you talk about that in a wonderful way. Kristen, do you want to say something about this?
Yeah, I think that's a great question and a good comment. And I also want to put that we're still having the conversation around boys and masturbation. It's still a male issue, and girls are that's even still taboo, that girls are masturbating, and what do we do with that? And that boys enter into a relationship having much more understanding around their body, and girls enter a relationship hoping the guys have an understanding of their body, because there's just this taboo. So when I hear that call, I really appreciate it. And I go, well, what about the girls? Where's that conversation?
Let's take a break and come back in a moment. Steve, thank you very much for the call. We have with us Kristen Hodson, a certified sex therapist, founder and director of the Healing Group in Salt Lake City. Jennifer Finlayson Fife is an LDS therapist outside of Chicago joining us. Chris Deuce is host of the podcast, the Celestial Sex Podcast, which we should mention was recently listed in Esquire's top 10 podcasts about sex. He's joining us from Culver City, California. Jennifer's in Chicago. Kristen's here in the studio, and we'll take your calls and more questions when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Mormons and sex. And another warning, although we're way into this show, by now you know we're talking about sex. And so there's some rather candid conversation going on. So just be forewarned. We're talking with Kristen Hodson, an LDS therapist, Jennifer Finlayson Fife, also an LDS therapist, Chris Deuce, who hosts the Celestial Sex Podcast. Chris, say something about your podcast, if you would. One thing you've mentioned is that you created the podcast that you wish you had had when you were like 15, I think you said.
Right. Yeah. So my producer Colin Hatch and I, we started the podcast with this desire to normalize like talking about sex. So we started gathering our friends together that were willing to open up and share stories about their childhoods, what their parents taught them about sex, what they think and feel about sex now. And we're about 30 interviews deep. We started last year. And what we've noticed is that people are really anxious to talk about it, whether it's publicly. Most of our interviews, people have asked to be on the show. People want to share their experience. Or privately in emails, we get so many messages from people that are largely just them wanting to open up. It's like a short sentence of like, hey, thanks for making the podcast. And then their story.
Yeah.
And, you know, I get to learn and read all this stuff. But if there was another outlet and not just a fringe Mormon podcast, if there was another outlet in our communities to talk about this stuff, I think the anxiety around sex would go down and people would be having more pleasureful sex and healthier sex.
Yeah. Let's take another call. Amy is with us in Salt Lake City. Amy, welcome.
Thank you.
Sure.
So I grew up in the Mormon church, and the only message I ever really got, this was in the 80s, from my parents or the church leaders, is that sex was bad and I was not to do it ever. So it was always no, 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 no. And then as soon as I got married, go, 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 go. And so that was really, really confusing, very scary, and really very intimidating.
Yeah.
So, you know, I feel like the education piece is really a big deal. And I didn't want my daughter to go through the same thing. So I started making a few notes, which turned into writing a book. And now it's a book that is given out by some OBGYNs in Utah County to young women as they come in for their premarital exam. And it really goes through everything, including the mechanics of sex, and is very detailed, very frank, but also in a very friendly way to make it easy to understand. And I just wanted to share that in case there are any people out there listening that may need some education regarding sex before they get married.
Amy, that's called sex education. Are you saying that there should be something like that in the school?
I think so.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Which gets us to the question, Kristen. Maybe you could say something about that. That I do want to get back to a question about on the honeymoon, go, 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 as opposed to no, no, no. So hold off on that. But just sex education, the fact that these policies are being passed by, for the most part, the vast majority of them are Latter-day Saints.
Yeah, I was heavily involved in this last legislative session, and it was fascinating to watch the process and to watch the opposition and to see what people interpreted as sex education. The idea that we're going to be teaching oral sex to kids in third grade instead of starting with the basic fundamentals of what is a healthy relationship, boundaries, consent, these principles that can be taught without ever talking about sex and have everything to do with sex. And in the legislative session, there was one we were talking about, something came up about rape and the word vagina came up, and one of the legislators pushed a button and said, whoa, whoa, we need to calm the conversation that is happening in here. And the climate around sex education in Utah and who is deciding, there were two women in there, and it was shot down very quickly. But there's even a lack of education around what sex education is, what it would look like, and all of that.
Yeah. Jennifer Finlayson-Fife, to the question that Amy mentioned originally, what are you hearing from your clients and the people that you talk to mm-hmm. about their wedding night?
Oh, yeah. Not fun times for the women anyway. The men are like, great, I get to do this for eternity. And the women are thinking, I got married for this. So, that transition is very challenging.
What do you mean? They're not told this is the clitoris and this is an orgasm.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they're not really told that.
I think some women and men figure these things out just by kind of educating themselves before they get married and so on. But certainly there's no formal education that's happening through the church, and if you're in Utah, probably through the schools. But I would say that there's also another element that I think is not just about the mechanics of sexuality and orgasm, but just the psychological notion to think of oneself as a sexual being. And I think we wreak havoc on both men and women in the church culture around their sexuality. I do think we tell men that they are inherently sexual because they are men after all, but their sexuality could take them down spiritually. That it's a thing they have. I mean, they have it as men, but that it could actually harm a woman. So I think men have a lot of ambivalence. Believing LDS men have a lot of ambivalence about their sexuality. And I think sometimes in the context of marriage now see it as like, finally, I don't have to restrain myself anymore. Finally, I have a wife who can legitimize my sexuality. And there's a kind of entitlement in that position and an immaturity in that position that's really undermines happy marital sexuality. For women, I think women often grow up thinking, if I am a good woman, I am inherently not sexual or less sexual. And my goodness is expressed in wanting to be sexual for him and helping him not kind of fall to his lower, baser desires. And so their sexuality is constructed in reference to his sexuality. So this idea of no, 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 and now suddenly I'm supposed to show up and be sexual, there's no psychological integration. And I'm speaking very categorically, but for many women that I work with, there has been no psychological integration of an identity as a sexual being, as a person who has legitimately has access to her own pleasure, her own sexual self, even to have a sexual self to share in the context of marriage. And I think this goes back a little bit to the notions of masturbation that the first caller was bringing up, that we construct it as a threat rather than normative sexual development. That we may want to think about wisely and how are we in relationship to this emerging part of being human for what it creates in our life. But the shaming of it is deeply destructive and I think is, in my view, anti-spiritual because it's a repressive and shaming position that undermines people's ability to create intimate, loving relationships.
Kristen, if a woman's identity is all caught up in her idea of being pure, what happens when she gets married? Because you've talked about duty sex, for example.
Right. And I empathize as I'm listening to Jennifer. That's what came up with for me is I empathize with these women where much of their development is and their identity is in being pure, the purity, and then save myself till marriage and then the fireworks of the romantic dream. And as Jennifer's saying, it's not like that. Sex is messy. Sex is complicated. Sex is a skill. And if she doesn't understand her body, it's going to have very little pleasure if it's just penetrative intercourse. But that identity in being pure, there can be a real grief process around that of this is a big part of my identity and now it just has to go away and I'm supposed to be excited about it and now be enthusiastic to engage in all of these sexual behaviors when I don't even know my own body. So it really is in relation to the partner's desires because she hasn't had her own context to develop in.
Let's take another call. Anna Dean is with us calling from South Jordan. Anna Dean, hi.
Hi. So my call has to do with my 8-year-old daughter. I have young children, and last Sunday she came home from church and mentioned in passing that she needed to put a sweater on over her dress. She had a sundress on that didn't have sleeves on. And I kind of lost my mind. I said, who told you that you needed to put a sweater on? And we had a long conversation, and I found out that they had had a modesty lesson in primary. And anyway, long story short, after I talked to the sister who gave the lesson, she said that she was very careful to use what was given to her as far as, like, the church-approved lesson, right? And also she mentioned to me that they used in the primary lesson for kids under the age of 12 the strength of the youth the wording from the strength of the youth pamphlet. So my biggest issue with what happened was not the teacher but the implementation of these ideas. That first of all, when they're little kids, they need to be taught as little kids. They, you know, she's 8 years old. She's not a sexual being yet that way, right? She hasn't gone through puberty. So to have her having to think about covering up because, and these are the words she used. She said, my shoulders would be distracting. And I thought, to a little girl or, you know, who would be distracted by a little girl's shoulders? The idea that at that age she should already be thinking of herself as a sexual thing. And also, I think that, and I read the lesson that she prepared, the language in The Strength of the Youth is directed mostly at girls, how girls should dress. And I think what that does when it's directed mostly at women is that it reinforces this idea that women are in control not only of their own sexual purity or whatever, but also boys, that they have somehow have control or are able to control boys' feelings or men's feelings or whatever. So, you know, we're reinforcing this idea that women are in control of this instead of letting boys have their own agency. And I think it also encourages body objectification for girls at such an early age. They're already starting to think of themselves as something to be looked at and put in certain ways or, you know, so that they're not tempting.
Yeah. Kristen.
I'm pretty upset.
Oh, Jennifer, do you want to jump in there?
Oh, yeah. I just have.
I'm guessing you're nodding.
I could say a lot I could say on this. But yeah, I wrote a piece on the modesty rhetoric for Exponent 2 magazine a couple of years ago around how, you know, paradoxically we are sexualizing our 8-year-olds. We are actually creating sexual consciousness within these young girls and also giving them the idea that they are in charge of other people's thoughts and feelings, not their own. And so I think it's a very problematic paradigm, and it's the beginning of this idea that women are the sober drivers in sexual interactions between men and women, and therefore they have to manage their sexual nature, that it's a threat, that you know, it's that they're responsible for something they can't possibly control, which is the thoughts and feelings of others. And so I think it's highly problematic.
That was my experience when I was a young man. I would, like, you know, test the girl's boundaries, whoever I was, you know, making out with, I would push it and let her push back. Like, she was right. definitely in control of how far I was going to go.
And then, in that moment, she can be shamed, and she can be the problem because
she didn't put
the brakes on. And so now it can be like, oh, she's not a girl for me. She's not the kind of woman I want to marry.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I felt like a few of the people that I dated, like when I would look back on our relationship, I'd be like, yeah, good thing I didn't end up with her. She was, you know, quite the harlot. and that's, you know, I feel terrible about that now, but at the time that made sense with my paradigm where my salvation was at risk, and you know, she was the only thing standing between me and getting into heaven, because at no point was I ever taught that I was actually completely in control of my own behavior.
When we get back from a break, I want to talk about how you changed course, how you changed that paradigm that Chris was just talking about. Chris Deuce, host of the Celestial Sex Podcast, Jennifer Finlayson Fife, an LDS therapist outside of Chicago. And here in the studio, we have Kristen Hodson, an LDS therapist and director of the Healing Group in Salt Lake City, co-author of the book Real Intimacy. We'll take another quick break and come back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about Mormons and sex and some of the conflicting ideas and practices. It's really been an interesting conversation. Kristen Hodson is with us, Jennifer Finlayson Fife, and Chris Deuce, they're all with us too. So I want to get you all on this question of how do Latter-day Saints live within the constraints of the law, yet in a healthy way? And let me just ask this first, and I wonder, do you, Kristen and Jennifer, when you're talking, what do you say to people about this law of chastity? Like, do you say you need to obey it, or do you say try to be flexible? And what do you do?
So the way that people oftentimes will come in and say, what can I do? What are the rules? And again, because they haven't developed their own authority, they have their first authority, which can be the church telling them. And if they're unfortunate, but it's highly likely that they can end up in a sex addiction treatment center, oftentimes they will become the new authority of what's healthy, what's okay, what's not okay. And I like to help them develop their own sense of sexual health within their relationship, and to have to start negotiating with each other, talking about it, and wrestling with we are the authority over our lives, our bodies, our relationship. And so this means we're going to have to start wrestling and negotiating some really complex,
difficult
things.
But that's got to be hard
things.
When there is an authority, though. What do you mean you're the authority when there is another authority?
Well, when it gets into marriage, the law is really simple. Anything that is coercive, unnatural, or abusive. Okay, that's a lot of interpretation. Unnatural, sticking a tongue in an ear. It's really unnatural for a tongue to go there. So you could apply that everywhere. So for them to have to wrestle with what's healthiest for them individually and as a couple is one of the healthiest things I think they can do.
Jennifer, what do you think?
Yeah, very similarly, I am really talking to people about, you know, if you believe that the law of chastity is right and you believe that it's the right way for you to behave, then I think that's important for you to behave that way. Meaning I want people to think more for themselves around what their choices are in complex situations, whether they're married or single. I mean, the church has a problem currently, or a challenge currently, in that there are more singles than ever because the age of marriage has gotten older and older, and more in a context of sexual liberalism. And so there's many LDS singles who are struggling around, what do I believe, what do I value, what do I want to choose, with high implications either way, right? Because there's a very, I would say, a very high demand and high stakes position around the law of chastity. So these aren't easy choices for people to make, but I'm often asking people to really think about what they believe is right, what their choices are creating in them and in their lives, whether or not those choices are pointing them towards what they ultimately want to create or have in their lives. Because that's a very important, I mean, our theology has the notions of obedience and deference to authoritative figures who are speaking God's positions. But we also have a balanced and equally important ideology of personal revelation, the ability to make decisions and discern in one's life, what is the spirit of this law? What is it? You know, for example, I had a client who was living in his parents' basement in his 30s, had lived the law of chastity or For the Strength of Youth pamphlet with 99% perfection. That is, he never went to any movies, even PG movies, because he might have sexual feelings. He didn't go on dates because he might encourage sexual feelings. And his development was stunted. His ability to be in a relationship was completely non-existent because he had so much anxiety about his sexuality. That clearly is not creating what we hope to create through the law of chastity. And so helping people to kind of tease apart a sort of what I think of as a more immature relationship to ideology, even Christ challenged that idea, that this very rigid interpretation precludes the capacity to develop into a person capable of deep love and deep integrity. And so the laws are there to facilitate that development. But you shouldn't make the law the kind of false safety as we often do.
We're going to have to continue this conversation again. I think we will. There's a lot to talk about. Kristen and I were saying off the air we could do another, couple of hours on this. So we'll leave it there. Jennifer Finlayson-Fife, an LDS therapist outside of Chicago, joined us from Chicago Public Radio. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Chris Deuce is host of the Celestial Sex podcast. I mentioned Esquire called it one of the top 10 podcasts about sex. We're glad you joined us. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks.
And Kristen Hodson, an LDS sex therapist at the Healing Group in Salt Lake City, co-author of the book Real Intimacy, A Couple's Guide to Healthy, Genuine Sexuality. Thank you for joining us.
It was a pleasure.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. Thanks for all the comments, by the way, today, folks. I'm Doug Fabrizio.